first, I guess.
All right. Good evening, everybody. Or I guess good afternoon. It's not evening. It's just afternoon. I call this meeting of Property and Local Tax Division to order. There is barely a quorum present. May I have a motion to approve the minutes from February 24th, 2020?
So moved.
Representative Hertas, thank you very much. Representative Hertas moves approval of the minutes from February 24th, 2020. Any discussion? Hearing none. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails and the minutes are approved. All right, moving along here. The first bill we have for consideration is House File 3567. I'll move House File 3567 be laid over for possible inclusion in the division report. We have the bill before us. Yes, everybody's got the bill. Members, these are the Property and Local Tax Division provisions from the Department of Revenue's policy and technical bill. So instead of presenting the bill myself, we're going to have the Department of Revenue come up, and they've already are there, ready to go. Great. And walk us through the bill. First, though, I'll move the author's amendment. Does anybody have the author's amendment? It's the A1. Yes. Good. I'm seeing heads nodding. Fantastic. Any discussion on the amendments? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, the motion prevails and is adopted. Whew. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks for being here today. If you would please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Joanna Bears, and I'm the Legislative Director for the Minnesota Department of Revenue. As many of you know, our mission at the department is working together to fund Minnesota's future. Together is the most important word in our mission. We know we cannot do our work without you and your staff. One of the strategies used to achieve the department's vision is that we are listening to our customers to identify and develop improvements to our revenue system. While working with our customers, we often notice items in the tax code that could be clarified, corrected, or updated. These items may be small, but are important to ensure clarity and effectiveness in the tax code. This year, we had the opportunity to work with members and staff while putting together our bill. We want to thank them for their participation and their time. We appreciate their expertise and their feedback they provided as we're developing and drafting our proposals. Their partnership is invaluable. We also want to thank the 70-plus stakeholders that attended our walkthrough. We appreciate their partnership and their feedback they provided. And then we also want to thank you, Mr. Chair, for authoring our bill. We appreciate your support. At this time, I will turn over to our department attorneys who will walk through the provisions of this bill, starting with Article 1. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Good afternoon, Chair Carlson and members. My name is Kelly McCormick, and I'm an attorney with the Minnesota Department of Revenue. I'll be walking you through Article 1.
Ms. McCormick, can you bring that mic a little closer, please?
Is that better?
A little bit.
How about now?
That's better, yeah.
Okay. I'll be walking you through Article 1 of the bill. Section 1 would combine two reports of the Board of Assessors, one of which is sent to the governor and the other is sent to the legislature, into a single report. These reports contain duplicative information. The combined report would be submitted in October of even years, which would be the next date either of these reports is required to be completed. Sections 2 and 3 clarify that the construction date of a wind energy conversion system or a solar energy generating system is not altered if the system is replaced, repaired, or otherwise maintained or altered. These changes will make it clear to those taxpayers that their combined nameplate capacity determination will not be impacted by repairs to their system. Section 4 allows the commissioner to correct clerical errors to the notification of tax sent to the county auditor and to the owner of a solar energy generating system until December 31st. This change will align the time period for correcting clerical errors to the corresponding provisions found within the wind energy production tax statute. Section 5 clarifies what powers and duties are to be formed by the city assessor in jurisdictions where there is both a city assessor and a county assessor. Section 6 would provide that licensed assessors must complete 30 hours of education on Minnesota laws and administration over the four-year licensing cycle. Rather than requiring assessors to complete the same training during a week-long course, which is currently known as the PACE course, this will provide more flexibility for assessors, as well as allow the department to provide more timely training if there's changes to the law during the licensing cycle. Section 7, 8, and 10 payment in lieu of taxes references in Minnesota Statute 273.124, Subdivision 14, Section 273.8.18, and Section 477A.10 are amended to include cross-references to Minnesota Statute 477A.17, which is the Lake Vermilion Sudan Underground Mine State Park Hilt Statute. And Section 9 amends the statute for modifying the mortgage registry tax exemption for mortgage loans made under a low or moderate income housing program to include mortgages that are assigned to a federal, state, or local government agency. This change will make it clear to those lenders that they are exempt from the tax and they will be able to file the mortgage without collecting the tax from the borrower upon closing. This concludes Article 1, and I'm happy to stand for questions.
Members, any questions on Article 1? I prefer we take questions by article, just based on the volume of material here. Seeing none, we can move on to Article 2.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Chelsea Griffin, and I'm a staff attorney with the Minnesota Department of Revenue. I'll be walking you through Article 2 today. I'll begin with a brief background to give you context as to why these provisions were drafted in the policy and technical bill. The 2019 legislature passed recodification of Chapter 69 as a part of the tax bill. Chapter 69 contained a confusing mixture of fire state aid, police state aid, insurance law, and pension programs. The recodification took the various provisions of Chapter 69 and placed them in new chapters of the law or existing chapters that were logically connected to the subject matter of the provision. The enacted recodification was purely technical in nature, meaning that there were no substantive changes to the fire state aid or police state aid programs or to the other provisions. In the process of drafting the technical recodification, the Department of Revenue, along with the external subject matter experts that volunteered their time to the project, identified many opportunities for administrative efficiencies and modernization to the fire state aid and police state aid programs. These ideas are now in the language of Article 2, which is before you. These provisions were drafted with the assistance of the Office of the State Auditor, members of the Minnesota Fire Association Coalition, the Minnesota Police Chiefs Association, the Department of Public Safety, and a subject matter expert from the City of Moundsview. I'll provide a broad overview of the changes that are contained in this article. Sections 1, 18 to 20, and 22 to 24 provide deadlines and procedures where statute is currently silent. The language provides clarity on when the Office of the State Auditor is to file financial compliance reports with the Department of Revenue and how long a municipality has to file an appeal regarding its apportionment of fire state aid or police state aid. The language also addresses how adjustments to correct a fire state aid or police state aid payment due to a clerical error are to be handled, and how special taxing districts or joint powers entities are to be paid. Several sections amend or add definitions to the fire state aid chapter of law. Section 3 adds a definition of apportionment agreement, which is a form used by the department when multiple fire departments provide fire protection service to the same municipality. Sections 4 to 8 update and create definitions regarding joint powers entities and fire protection special taxing districts. Sections 9 to 11 amend the criteria for a fire department to receive fire state aid. The qualification criteria in current law does not reflect the operations of a 21st century fire department. Accordingly, the department worked with stakeholders to agree on new appropriate criteria for purposes of qualifying for fire state aid. These include requiring a fire department to have a fire department identification number and be dispatched by a 911 service. Sections 12 to 14 and sections 16 and 17 create filing and data usage requirements that ensure the commissioner is using the most up-to-date data to collect or to calculate fire state aid. For example, the amendments require reporting of the fire department service area of a fire department, which is information necessary to calculate fire state aid, but is not required under current law as a part of the fire state aid certification. Sections 15 and 21 make amendments to the notification process and penalties that relate to fire state aid and police state aid. The most significant changes are the reduction of the penalty time period from 20 weeks to 10 weeks and the replacement of a 10-day grace period after the March 15th due date with a March 1st notification to municipalities that have not yet submitted a fire state aid or police state aid certification to the commissioner. Finally, sections 2 and 25 eliminate language that is outdated and no longer needed by the department. Mr. Chair, this concludes Article 2.
Thank you. Any questions with regards to Article 2? Yes, Representative Rumbach.
So, Mr. Chair, this the issue of fire protection special taxing districts. I don't know how many we have currently authorized in the state. One or two, right? One. So, boy, this sounds an awful lot like let's have a whole bunch more. And so where do we get that that's a good idea? I very much feel like this is way ahead of its time.
Yeah, I think our testifiers can speak to that.
Mr. Chair, Representative, so currently because there is a fire protection special taxing district, the fire stated chapter of the law is silent on how we would have to treat that special taxing district for purposes of fire state aid. So by adding a definition here, it clarifies how fire state aid interacts with that existing special taxing district.
Yes, well said. And to be clear, this does not create any new districts, but it does address the one that's in existence. So it doesn't create any new ones at this time?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Okay, very good. Just want to make sure we got that on the record. Representative Drazkowski had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm curious, which fire departments were included in this group that you met with that developed these in coordination with you?
Mr. Chair, I can, and Representative, we had a stakeholder group, and the individuals that provided subject matter expertise to us represented the fire community generally. We did not meet with the specific fire departments.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Representative Jaskowski.
I think it's important to know that there's a lot of differences between rural volunteer fire departments and those that work for pay and those that are urban volunteer fire departments. They're all very much different. They do a lot of jockeying between each other and have over time. And I haven't studied all these provisions, but there's a chance that one of them might not be represented in here. So I'm concerned that especially our rural volunteer departments had representation in this. So if you could give us a list of who those folks were, that might be helpful.
Mr. Chair, Representative, so I can reiterate the groups that we met with, if that would be sufficient.
Representative Jaskowski?
Oh, it's a good start, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Sure. So we met with the Office of the State Auditor, members of the Minnesota Fire Association Coalition. So that's the Fire Chiefs Association, the Fire Departments Association. We met with the Minnesota Police Chiefs Association, as there are police state aid changes here. The Department of Public Safety, so that was the State Fire Marshal's office that had a representative. And a historic subject matter expert from the City of Moundsview.
Yeah, thank you, Ms. Griffin. Mm-hmm. Representative Jaskowski.
Well, Mr. Chair, I didn't hear our rural fire departments represented in there, but I need to maybe get in touch with them and see what their understanding is, too, and certainly do a better job reading the bill, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Very good. Representative Rumbach, you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm just curious, in the Section 7, that municipality, every fire state aid group receives tax state aid now. If you can explain the need for changing the definitions, because what was wrong, I guess, with the current definitions?
Ms. Griffin.
Mr. Chair, Representative, so as I previously stated, the statute is silent on how we treat joint powers entities and fire protection special taxing districts. They do exist, and they need to be treated for purposes of the fire state aid program. And so this is codifying the administrative practice that we have in getting those entities to receive fire state aid. You will notice that you mentioned Section 7, so that we are eliminating Park District subject to Chapter 398 in the University of Minnesota. Those were actually carryovers from when the police state aid and the fire state aid definition of municipality was the same. And those entities only receive police state aid, so that's why they're eliminated here. But again, it's just trying to it's creating language so that we can administer this program as codified.
So, Mr. Chair, follow up. So how will fire state aid be distributed differently with these definitions? I mean, it's, fire state aid has gone to these districts through their municipalities, if you're a joint powers, right? So this is going to go direct to the JPAs? Just want that clarification.
Ms. Griffin?
Mr. Chair, Representative, so there won't be changes as to how we're administering fire state aid for purposes of joint powers entities and fire protection special taxing districts. This is codifying the administrative practice because we've had to interpret statute as to how we treat these entities. In terms of payments and how they would be paid, that is also codified. Our practice is codified in or it is proposed in this bill. And I'm sorry, I'm looking for the language, Mr. Chair. It is in section 19 in the payment section. And so it discusses that for a joint powers entity, for example, paragraph D addresses how they have to designate a city or town to be paid fire state aid on its behalf in its first year that it's eligible.
Thank you.
Well, Mr. Chair,
just
a follow-up. Mm-hmm. I mean, will this language allow for distribution of fire state aid to go direct to the JPAs? Or this fire taxing district, in which case they'll be completely independent from their cities.
Mr. Chair, Representative, so the language here, it says that the joint powers entity would need to designate a city or town, so a municipality, to be paid the fire state aid on its behalf.
Thank you.
Other member questions? Thank you, Ms. Griffin.
Thank you.
We have one article left, Article 3. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members, my name is Ron Schultz. I am a staff attorney at the Minnesota Department of Revenue. I will walk you through Article 3. Section 1 amends Minnesota Statutes Section 270C-22 Subdivision 1 to correct the statutory year calculation of inflation for the property tax refund amounts. Section 2 was removed by the author's amendment. Section 3 repeals Minnesota Statute Section 270C-17 Subdivision 2, which requires local units of government whose local sales tax is administered by the department to pay for the costs of developing a new computer system for administering local taxes. This subdivision is unnecessary for a few reasons. The department never developed a standalone computer system just for administering local taxes. The department moved to an integrated tax system in 2008, meaning all tax types are handled by the same system, not just sales tax. The department does not anticipate the development of a standalone system for sales tax. A subdivision 1 of the same section provides that if the commissioner agrees to collect a local tax, the local unit of government must agree that all of the direct and indirect costs of the department for collecting the tax and any other statewide indirect costs will be deducted from the amounts collected and paid to the local unit of government. And similarly, a section in the sales tax chapter concerning the administration of local sales tax provides that before a local jurisdiction is paid local sales tax revenues, the commissioner is required to deduct any direct or indirect costs to administer, audit, and collect sales tax. This concludes Article 3.
Thank you, Mr. Schultz. Any questions with regards to Article 3? Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do see the language on page 27, lines 27.21 through 24. I'm curious, you include the individual taxpayer identification number in there. That would that allow illegal aliens to be to go through this? I'm trying to remember what this this deals with, the certificate of rent paid. Would this allow them to be included in this system and not identified?
Representative Drazkowski, I got an answer for you on that one. So that was deleted as part of the author's amendment and is traveling separately going before judiciary? Yeah, judiciary. So that particular piece has been pulled out.
I'm wondering, Mr. Chair, if the testifier could talk about that.
Yeah, absolutely. Mr. Schultz.
I have to defer to Joanna here.
Mr. Chair, Representative Duszkowski, this language here specifically allows the department to collect individual taxpayer identification numbers in the, for tax or for landlords to register as a landlord with the department in order for us to start the process of electronic filing for certificates of rent paid. So what we're just doing is asking landlords to contact us. The department has authority to get it from taxpayers, but we don't for the landlord for this piece. And so this is just us getting it to register a landlord.
Thank you, Ms. Mayor. Representative Duszkowski.
Mr. Chair, if I could. So, I mean, the department has to see something entered for an identification number of some sort. So is the adding the individual taxpayer identification number a new authorized policy direction for the department?
Ms. Bears.
Mr. Chair, Representative Duszkowski, what this is doing is that we are trying to create an electronic electronic form for people to file their certificates of rent paid. And so what this does is anytime we have someone communicating with our systems with an electronic means, we have to have some way to identify those taxpayers. And so we're just asking to collect the taxpayer identification number, which could be a Social Security number, a federal ID number, or a Minnesota State ID number, in order to have them register with us in our system, because we need some kind of confidential information to talk to our systems. We just can't let anyone to.
So Mr. Chair, I'm wondering,
Representative Jessica, yeah,
if so if a taxpayer wouldn't have one of these numbers, what would happen?
Ms. Bears, and again, I know just we are getting a little, this has been removed from the bill, but if you want to answer the question, please proceed.
Mr. Chair, Representative Duszkowski, they wouldn't be able to register as a landlord with our system.
Representative Duszkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you did answer my question. So it does appear adding the ITNN will allow people who are illegal aliens to register as a landlord with this new electronic system. I'd be interested where that language is going, Mr. Chair, as we follow it. Thank you.
It will be going before the Judiciary Committee. I don't know if a hearing has yet been set for that. We can check with Chair Lesh. Members, questions on Article 3? Seeing none. Testimony from the audience. Mr. Rice, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Brian Rice. I represent the Minnesota Professional Firefighters Association. I have two general comments and one specific thing I think the committee should consider. First off, fire state aid is one of the first state taxes and been around for about 150 years. The money goes to pay pensions. If you're a volunteer department, the money the state passes out hopefully eventually winds up in the pockets and pensions of volunteer firefighters who worked a career and gave money. Or if you're a full-time city, the money will go to the city to help them pay the pension costs. It's about $28 million a year that's distributed by a formula. It's very important to the people I represent. As full-timers, I also do some part-time work. I think the bill itself administratively is good, but it is a technical bill. It is administrative. There are penalties put on here if people don't get their reports in, and there's fines that are paid. The question is, who's going to pay those fines? I would submit it's the firefighters who are supposed to get the benefit of the pension dollars. That's just a philosophical question, but it's important. What I'd like to do is call the committee's attention to is page 20, line 2.3 of the bill. I believe this would be in the category of an efficient change. Right now, that money is distributed based on two principles. One is 50% population. The other one is 50% valuation. Basically, it's all market value, including exempt property. So it kind of falls across the state, and that valuation number is dynamic. As I understand the formula, it changes every year based on your total market value of everything. Our good friends in the farm community get their share based on their market value, not their assessed value, and that's a big difference. But herein is the key. As long as I've followed this for nearly 40 years, the population formula is based on the decennial census. Once every 10 years, the population number changes. What this bill would do is change the population number annually based on the current estimates of the state demographer. So, and we'll have a big change next year when the census is done. That'll reboot all these numbers, and that's happened decade after decade. But for members that might be in communities that have declining population and will decline in the future, in the next 10 years, I would urge members that represent communities that are losing population to examine what this change might mean to your communities. And that would include cities that I represent in greater Minnesota, or not rather, cities. The Minnesota Professional Firefighters now has about 50 locals. They're all around the state, Winona, Austin, Owatonna. We also have Minneapolis and St. Paul. Some suburban, we're growing suburban communities, but Duluth, Iron Range cities. Bloomington is not a professional department, Mr. Chair, but they are a volunteer department, and it just depends. If you adopt this change on lines 20.3 to 20.7, you're changing a state formula that's now going from decennial calculations to annual calculations, and it's not an insignificant amount of money.
Thank you, Mr. Rice. Appreciate your testimony.
And I would ask the members to think about who the intended beneficiaries of this money are. I mean, the Department of Revenue, the OSA, technically it's important, but sometimes you might lose sight of who's the money is supposed to be going to help.
Questions for the testifier? Questions for Mr. Rice?
Yes,
Representative
Mr. Chair, and to the members, yeah, this pension is really important for recruitment and retention in all parts of our state for volunteers as well as full-time members. It's one more thing. In many cases, it's not a lot, but it's something to say thank you for the 20 years of service. And I know in my summer travels when I checked out the volunteer services with both EMS and fire, that this was one of the biggest things that they say keeps them there during that time. And right now, we can't not afford to lose any of these volunteers. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Further questions? Oh, yes, Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Rice, can you tell us my fire departments in rural Wabasha, Winona, Goodhue counties, who represented them in the discussion with the department?
Mr. Rice.
Mr. Chair, I could not answer that question. We weren't there. I mean, I think the people that were here were in good faith, the chiefs and other ones, but I would really urge you to examine what lines 20.3 to 20.7 might do if you could model what would have happened the last decade.
Thank you. And Mr. Chair, I second that really kind of high stakes effect to this language as we try to wrap our heads around it. I know that our rural departments, as they look at this pension formula, have been frustrated because, for instance, some of the suburban volunteer fire departments get a lot more per firefighter, a lot more, because the formula is based on the number of people in their community rather than amount per firefighter. And in rural Minnesota, we really, really struggle, and Representative Hewitt is correct. It's an important piece for us to recruit people, and This is a big deal for all firefighters, and I want to make sure all of them are involved in this, and I'm not so sure they have been.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Drazkowski. Further questions for the testifier? Ms. Bears, would you care to make some closing comments?
Sure.
I'm sorry. Any other members from the audience wishing to speak on behalf of this bill? Okay. Seeing none. Ms. Bears.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Just in closing, as you start to put your report together, if you have questions or issues arise, we appreciate the opportunity to work with anybody on finding those solutions or answers. Thank you again for this opportunity to present.
Thank you. So with that, I'll renew my motion that House File 3567, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion in the division reports, and the bill is laid over. Next item on the agenda deals with LGA, local government aid, and CPA distribution issue that Representative Drazkowski raised on our first day of session, our first meeting. Now that we're past the February forecast, I've asked the Department of Revenue to explain what happened before the committee. I see we have our testifier. Welcome. Please introduce yourself for the record, and if you could walk us through the issue, and then we can take some questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Andrea Fish. I'm here today on behalf of the Property Tax Division of the Department of Revenue, as Chair Carlson mentioned, to talk about recertification for local government and county program aids that are payable this year. As you may know, we recertified these aides in February to ensure that all cities and counties receive the correct amount of aides under statute. We recertified these aides after discovering an error in our calculation of adjusted net tax capacities, or ANTCs, that are one of the components used for both LGA and CPA amounts. Now, the issue is isolated to three separate provisions in session law that require TIF districts in Minneapolis, South St. Paul, and St. Paul to be added back into those cities' tax bases for purposes of adjusted net tax capacities. Except for those three TIF districts and those three session laws, normally TIF districts are left out of those calculations. The result of not including those TIF districts in that ANTC calculation was that Minneapolis, St. Paul, and South St. Paul, as well as their counties of Hennepin, Dakota, and Ramsey, were all certified to receive a little more aid than they should have been. And because these are set appropriation amounts that are distributed between all of the cities and counties that receive them, it meant that other cities and counties were certified to receive less aid than they should have been. So on February 7th, corrected aid amounts were certified and communicated to all cities and counties. Under the distribution of the formula, 678 cities were certified to receive increased aid amounts ranging from $2 up to just over $36,000. 52 counties were also certified to receive increased aid amounts that ranged from around $1,100 to just over $33,000. Now, for aids payable in 2020, the cities of Minneapolis, St. Paul, South St. Paul, as well as their counties, will receive the amounts of aid that they were initially certified to receive in our effort to hold both those jurisdictions and their taxpayers harmless for this error. Going forward, however, their newly recertified amounts will be their base amounts for calculating these aids. At the Department of Revenue, we hold ourselves to very high standards of accuracy and excellence, and we apologize for this error. We were very grateful that we could take swift action to ensure that all cities and counties receive the correct amount of aid under law. And based on our review, we're confident that this issue has been resolved for this year and going forward. We're here today to address any questions that you might have.
Thank you, Ms. Fish. And I do appreciate you and your colleagues taking the time to meet with me personally to explain the issue and how the department has addressed it. So I appreciate that. Members, questions? Representative Jaskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Fish, do you have any handouts today or to show us the numbers or no?
Mr. Chair, Representative Jaskowski, I don't. I have some numbers available with me in my notes.
Okay. So, Mr. Chair, thank you. And Ms. Fish, so what I understand happened, and listening to you say it again, is that there were some counties that originally were certified a lower amount than they should have been finally, right? And so we're going to use the final one and correct them so they come up to the level they're supposed to be at. Additionally, there were some counties that initially were promised a higher amount according to the certification, but when then they were supposed to get finally. And so what the revenue department is doing and what is in the forecast is to also pay those that were mistakenly given a higher certification than they should have been and give them that higher amount even though they're really supposed to get a smaller amount. And apparently, and I did look, you have a place in statute that gives you the authority to do that, which I think is terrible policy. So what we're going to do is we're going to pay those counties the higher amount even though that's not the amount they're supposed to get, under the belief that we want to do that because they're into the budgeting process or they're going to be, and we don't want to mess up their figures. Is that the right capture on this one, Ms. Fish?
Ms. Fish.
Mr. Chair, Representative Jaskowski, to probably repeat what you said, make sure we're on the same page, and I think we are. When we certified the amounts last year, those were used for budget purposes, as you discussed. So to hold those jurisdictions harmless, we are paying them the amount they were certified to receive. We did recertify for all of the other counties regardless because we need to make them whole in accordance with statute. So three counties will receive more aid than they should have been certified to receive. they will receive exactly what they were certified to receive.
Representative Dreskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Fish, that's how I understand it, too. So we're actually treating three counties better than the rest of the counties in regarding what they should get according to the formula. So anyway, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, and Representative Dreskowski, just to be clear, this will be corrected in the year 2021. So it's been identified and will be addressed next year.
But, Mr. Chair, it's a one-time inequity that
understood.
That we're providing for those three counties simply because there was a short-term mistake made.
Understood. Just wanted to provide that clarification. Representative Hertaus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Fish, you probably have some of those numbers. I had a visit from somebody from Department of Revenue about this. It was around 1.2 million, I think, is the number that we're talking about, that the department intends to distribute additional funds. And I think that I recall roughly two-thirds to three-fourths of that was in four entities. Most of it went to where some of the shortfall was. Could you just revisit some of those numbers? You probably have those available so everybody understands.
So, Ms. Fish, I also, in conversation with Michelle, may have some numbers to share, too. If you want to, Andrew, if you would like to try that, just know that there is additional help if necessary.
Certainly. Mr. Chair, Representative Hertaus, I believe you were asking about where the amounts were of that approximately 1.2 million. The city of Minneapolis, the difference was 834,000. St. Paul, about 67,000. South St. Paul, just under 54,000, and that was for LGA. So the total LGA local government aid recertification amount was a little over $955,000.
Representative Hertaus?
Could you repeat the second one again?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hertaus, for the city of St. Paul, was a little over $67,000.
And those were underpayments or overpayments?
Overpayments. Overpayments.
Okay. Thank you.
Member, Representative Petersburg, you had a question.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Ms. Fish, too. I'm going to follow up a little bit on Representative Dreskowski's question. Now, I understand that these three counties that were over-certified and got the higher payment, and that the certification will be corrected next year, but I didn't hear anything to clarify whether or not they're going to be able to keep this one-time windfall or if it's going to be subtracted from next year's actual payment in order to equalize that certification. I think that's the concern that I was questioning.
Representative Petersburg, yes, they will be able to keep the funds, but Ms. Fish, if you would like to expand.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that is correct. We don't have a precedence of demanding a payback in these scenarios. So as of today, the 2020 aid will be the amount they were certified to receive. Their 2021 aid will be recertified later this year based on updated data.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I agree with Representative Dreskowski. That seems like a poor precedent because in private practice and others, if we get more than rat, government's going to ask it back from us. So it's just something that I think is fair, and I don't mind the fact that it's under budgeting and we have to deal with it, but then they should be expecting to get less next year in order to be able to budget for that as well. It just seems like a precedent that's realistic.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Fish, just a question. Curious if the counties noticed this extra payment, and if so, did they contact the department stating that, hey, we got some extra money here? Or was it the department that realized the extra payment, the overpayment?
Ms. Fish.
Mr. Chair, Representative McDonald, we were not notified by any of the cities or counties. This was something that we noticed when we were analyzing these aids for forecast purposes.
Representative McDonald.
And a follow-up. Would the counties, the auditor, would have they noticed it? Would that be custom? I would imagine if you had $67,000 coming in more than your certified LGA, do you think that's something that they would have caught? Or do you think it was just missed by those who would see those numbers within the county?
Ms. Fish.
Chair Carlson, Representative McDonald, I can't comment on necessarily whether they would have noticed that or not. No one had mentioned it when we contacted them directly.
Representative Sikorski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I appreciate the conversation, Mr. Chair and members. I did get a bill drafted that does exactly what Representative Petersburg's thinking about, and that is if policy is and state law allows the department to make that larger payment that is bigger than what they're supposed to get, let's instead change policy. It says, you know what, city or county X, you were paid too much this time. A year from now, your LGA or CPA is going to be reduced by that same amount. You can take the extra money and put it in the bank and hold on to it for a year from now or whatever. But I'd ask, Mr. Chair, for a hearing on the bill and indulgence by the committee when we get to that point. Thank you.
We shall see. Representative Herr. Why don't
we do that? Chair, I just wanted to talk about, not that I want to minimize the issues of this error or this oversight, but I want to keep perspective that this error of under $1 million was 0.19% of the overall amount of LGA, and that it is really, though, I'm like I said, I'm not trying to diminish the importance of when a city gets overpaid, but if just to say thank you to the groups that actually calculate and do this work, I think that I have actually sat with my own city and looked at their LGA calculation. It is very difficult, and for like a city of St. Paul, they're getting $60,000, $65,000 extra is not a windfall of money. We actually have one of the greatest needs in our city. And so I do appreciate that this error is getting looked at, but for us to have perspective that this is a fraction of a percentage of what we are looking at. And so I appreciate the work that's being put into place to correct this and to keep perspective as to what we're actually looking at here and the cost it takes us to actually create more rules that we put into place to correct a 0.1% error, which when I worked in the corporate sector was called a rounding error.
Thank you, Representative Herr. Follow-up comments, Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate the department being straightforward and honest in admitting that the mistake was made and that you intended to deal with it, not necessarily the way some of us think it should be. But to Representative Herr's point, I guess, yes, it's a small amount of money, but it's still taxpayer money. And this really flies right in the face of more than 12% of all of the cities in Minnesota that are off a formula with LGA and get nothing. So when they hear about the fact that cities were overpaid substantial sums of money and they get nothing, it really generates a lot of concern with regard to having LGA being distributed in an equitable and a fair manner. All of these communities that are off formula absolutely contribute to the general fund, not only in the form of sales taxes and income taxes by their constituents, but also with fiscal disparities and other sources of revenue to the general fund. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Hertas. Further comment? Seeing none. All right. Ms. Fish, would you like to make a closing comment?
Mr. Chair, I will just reiterate that we also hold ourselves to very high standards of accuracy, and we certainly will work with any members on questions they have, follow up, and the usual. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Fish. We appreciate your testimony and you being here today. Next up, we have, let's see, where are we now? Representative Cantrell, there he is. House File 3167. Can I get a motion to move Representative Cantrell's bill before the committee? Representative Zhang moves that House File 3167 be laid over for possible inclusion in the division reports. We have the bill before us. Yes, good. Representative Cantrell, welcome. If you would please proceed with your testimony.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I appreciate you having me before you today. House File 3167 is a bill that would authorize the creation of TIF districts, tax increment financing districts in the city of Burnsville for the parcel including the Burnsville Center and kind of surrounding right-of-ways and roads. Burnsville Center is an important part of our community. That land's an important part of our community. As somebody who grew up in the area, that was one of my favorite spots as a teenager to kind of spend my days and spend some time, but As we all know, the brick and mortar infrastructure or in economy has changed significantly over the past 5 years, especially. So this is, I think, a vital component of looking at what the future of development in the city of Burnsville needs to incorporate. So this bill is a little bit different from last year when we brought it before the committee. With the committee's feedback and with the feedback of other members, and as a result of the conference committee process, we've kind of right-sized elements of the bill, and I think we have a really good product that we're bringing before the committee today. So with that, Mr. Chair, I will turn it over to Mayor Elizabeth Counts of Burnsville.
Welcome. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I thank you for allowing us to come before you and to speak to you this afternoon. With me is our city manager, Melanie Mascoli, and also I want to take the opportunity to thank Representative Cantrell for carrying this bill for us today and also last year. I'm Elizabeth Couts. I'm the mayor of the city of Burnsville. I'm here today to ask for your continued support of a special consideration to create a TIF district in the County Road 42 corridor site. Last year, we requested consideration of a bill that had significant exemptions. This committee supported that proposed TIF legislation with modifications of our former bill and was brought before the conference committee. And so I thank you for your support, and I thank you for your feedback, because we heard you and we took your feedback, and we reflect that and all those changes in the bill that is before you today, with one addition to assist with public safety. The project site is the south side of County Road 42, which is a very busy county road. We are asking to be able to use increment from outside the district for a much needed public crossing to improve public safety in the area. So we, the city of Burnsville, would like to transition this site into a mixed-use development, and we've already adopted all of the regulatory tools for land use and ordinance for the site. This will include high-density housing at the site. Without this legislation, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, the property values will continue to decline. TIF will help allow us to utilize public-private partnerships to accommodate public infrastructure. And so with that, we ask for your continued support, and I thank you for allowing us to be here this afternoon. We appreciate your consideration and your time. I'm Elizabeth Couts, along with our city manager, Melanie Mascoli, and we thank you, Representative Cantrell.
Thank you, Mayor. Question for you. The bill refers to this connection, this bridge or the tunnel that's outside the TIF boundaries. Is there some homing in on what that infrastructure might look like?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for asking the question. It will look like, so on Aldrich, there will be a tunnel.
Okay.
That'll help with pedestrian crossing and for automobile crossing, bike crossing. And it's a safety piece.
Sure. Thank you. Members, questions? Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A question for you, Mayor. You stated in your testimony that should this not continue on with the TIF district expanding it, that those property areas will continue to drop in as property values. You maybe expound a little bit as to why that would be.
Well,
Mayor.
Mr. Chair and Representative McDonald, thank you for the question. Right now, if you look at that particular area of our city, it is not blighted, but it is functionally obsolete. And we have worked very hard with all of our property owners, because that's how we do things in Burnsville. And we continue to see the decline in the property taxes because they are functionally obsolete.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mayor. Is that the shopping area, the Burnsville shopping area? And they got the
Yes,
had that
sir.
Whole area. I used to work down there. That was a very vibrant area back in the
day.
Late 80s.
Mr. Chair, and Representative McDonald, you're absolutely right. It was the place to go for anyone south of the river and from Nebraska, Iowa, and points south. But not much has been done about it. But what we did was to hold a convening of our community and our property owners to look at this site. And everybody is on board, and we did adopt all of the regulatory tools to help bring vibrancy back to that area and to include housing because it is needed. We are already built out, sir.
Representative McDonald?
Very good. Well, thank you. We're happy to help out with the Burnsville area.
Thank you for your help last year. I look forward to your continued support.
Mayor, I do appreciate your comment of the mall south of the river. That's much appreciated. Representative Marquardt.
Mr. Chair, you still have the best mall.
Thank you, Mayor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And as stated before, this TIF proposal with some modifications did pass out of the House last year. But if one of the testifiers could talk about how it's improved. You know, you're coming back with a little different plan. If you want to talk about how it's actually improved from the last one last year that passed the House. So what are some of the main differences?
A little bit of that, and then I'm going to have our city manager address a lot of the, perhaps some of the details. But you had given us some feedback about really looking at the TIF and making some changes to it. And we heard you. And so our city manager.
Please introduce yourself for the record. And
Melanie Lee, city manager for Burnsville. Mr. Chair and Representative Marquardt, thank you for that question. Last year's bill proposal before the committee for consideration had a number of exemptions. The committee indicated you weren't comfortable with those exemptions, and we heard you. So we skinnied down the bill. We reduced the footprint significantly to really focus on the Burnsville Center Mall area, which is the area for which we're seeing the most decline.
Chair Marquardt?
Thank you.
Okay. Yeah. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I live south of the city, so I used to visit Beardsville Mall a lot. Now, since I've been up here, I'm always rushing either up here or back home. But it looks to me like what you're doing is you're reclaiming a lot of the surface parking lot in order for these infrastructures. Is that correct?
Ms. Lee, or Madam Mayor.
Mr. Chair and Representative, yes, we have really taken that site and created a mixed use where it's, well, a lot of the area is now usable rather than sitting with the dark asphalt.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you. And the only little comment that I have is about it is as we do that, we allow for more flexibility of the use, and that's great. But it also requires more people coming back and forth. And so I'm just want to make sure that you have enough parking available for those. And so it doesn't create even more congestion in that area through that particular use. So just something to keep in mind. And thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Brumbeck, you had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Real quick, I don't see any specification of the length of the tax, the TIF district. And how long will it, or is it?
Ms. Lee?
Chair Carlson and Representative, we are not asking for any exception for the standard length of a TIF district.
Yeah. So, Mr. Chair, we're talking 15 years. Is that the length?
Yes, Ms. Hager has a
Mr. Chair and Representative Rumbach, typically redevelopment districts have a 25-year length, and this bill does not add any years to that
okay,
length.
Thanks very much.
Okay. Member questions?
Comment.
Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think you've made the case why it's really important in this year that we do have a tax bill.
He's stealing my thunder, I guess. Members from the audience, anybody here to testify on behalf of this bill? Okay. Seeing none, closing comments, Representative Cantrell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I appreciate your continued consideration. This is something that I think is a really invaluable tool for our city to continue to secure our economic future and the stability of and vibrancy of the city of Burnsville. So I appreciate your consideration. Thank you for your time today.
All right, wonderful. With that, Representative Zhang renews his motion that House File 3167 be laid over for possible inclusion in the division reports, and that bill is laid over. Next up, we have House File 3502. Yeah. Representative Anderson. Ah, there he is. Fantastic. May I have a motion to get Representative Anderson's bill before the committee? Looking for a motion. Representative Zhang, once again, fantastic. Moves that House File 3502 be laid over for possible inclusion within the division reports. We have the bill before us. Representative Anderson, welcome. If you could please present your bill.
Thanks, Mr. Chair and members. I enjoyed my time in this committee. You do some very important things, so thanks for hearing the bill. The reason for House File 3502 really is twofold. There's a great deal of concern among residents back where we live about the money being spent by the Sauk River Watershed District. And the second reason is that under current law, there's really no effective and permanent ceiling on the watershed's administrative general fund levy. The reason for that is because of a session law back in 2005. It was enacted and allowed the watershed an ongoing permanent waiver from the $250,000 cap that most watersheds operate under. And along with that waiver, they were granted authority to levy a 0.01% amount of the taxable market value in the watershed district for its general fund levy. So under current law, in the year payable 2020, the maximum they could levy is $869,000. Their actual levy for payable 2020 is $846,000, which is about 97% of the potential they could levy, but it's a pretty high number. Another concern among district residents is the size of some of the assessments being levied for projects within the watershed district. I have a couple of testifiers to go into that a little bit more fully and talk about some of the projects and the costs back in the district, Mr. Chairman.
Well, welcome. If you could please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Paul Hartman. I'm from Osakis, Minnesota. Well, Representative Anderson just took pretty much everything that I was going to say right out of my mouth, so he covered everything pretty well. The only thing I can add to what he said, if you look at the 1991 law that was passed that revised all of the watershed law that was written in 1955 approximately, that original levy was $125,000. Now, if you utilize inflation as a comparison, if those dollars today would come to approximately $237,000. So the $250,000 current cap that is in Minnesota State Statute 103D905 is well within the guidelines of the original law that was written in 1990. So the bill, the House File 3502, in our opinion, at capping it at $500,000 is very generous based on inflation and the original law.
Yes, Chairman and committee, thanks for having me here today. My name is Justin Dahlheimer. I'm a city councilman from the city of Osakis, and we've been watching throughout the past years here the watershed district stir up our community. We reside on the largest lake in the district, and what they've been doing in terms of their projects to try to improve our watershed has not been proven to be effective. And it takes us back to the timeline of the bill that was represented here from what Paul mentioned from 1991 through what Representative Anderson mentioned in 2005. I want to point to a 2007 legislative auditor report on watersheds, which brought up the point which we drove 2 hours to discuss with you today, is accountability. There's very little accountability on watershed districts to show the worth of these projects and the size of their budgets. And just quoting specifically from that report, the legislature should require Bowser to provide greater oversight of local water management entities and hold them accountable for their performance Specifically, the legislature should require Bowser to establish performance and operational standards for the districts, collect performance, financial, and activity data from each entity, monitor the performance and operations of the entities and compare them with established performance and operational standards, and finally, release public assessments of each entity's performance. In 2007, that was the recommendation. 13 years later, that is not what is currently happening. And we look at a budget that has been allowed to levy our taxpayers at an increased amount, and for what worth? And that's the discussions we've been having in our community, and that's been brought to our attention in numerous examples of their wasteful spending and their ability to use their operating levy to seed projects that become even more burdensome on our taxpayers without yielding an improved lake or improved river resources. Just recently, we've watched our school get a special assessment of $65,000 that was unanticipated, stemming from a 2002 project. We've witnessed them approve a building of the $1.9 to $2 million budget for eight people. And when asked and protest within meetings, they've said because they can afford to. What our community needs, what the watershed needs, is sewer around Lake Osakis. And we do not see their current path and their use of funds to be indicating that they're going to lead in that way and to get people's attention and to get a watershed district's attention that has been given an exceptional budget above and beyond what's necessary. We need accountability. And that's what we're asking for out of this bill, is to get the attention to have conversations with our communities that are affected in this watershed district about the worth of these projects, about where our funds are best spent, and how to use them together to yield the best result for our watershed. So I appreciate your time today, and thank you.
Thank you. Just for clarification, Mr. Dahlheimer, you mentioned you were a member of the City Council. Are you speaking on behalf of the City Council or as a citizen?
I'm not empowered specifically by the City Council to be here today. I'm here as a citizen.
Okay.
But I would say if you call them all up, they would be happy to have me here.
Just wanted to make sure. Question perhaps for the author, Representative Anderson. Seems like there's been quite a bit of debate within the community around this. Has information been presented in terms of what will happen in terms of water quality if this were to be enacted?
Mr. Chairman, no, I'm not aware. Obviously, if you reduce your expenses by $365,000 or so, it's going to cause some changes to be
imagine.
Made. Again, this is the administrative budget. It's not the budgets for actual projects. Those are assessed separately. So we're really talking about a couple of different things here.
Okay.
And I would just remind members that I've been around for a number of years as well, and this is one of the, maybe the exception to our basic axiom that taxation without representation. These watershed board members, nothing against them personally, but they are not elected. They are appointed by their respective county boards. And a lot of the frustration we hear is that these levies are being assessed against residents by people that are not elected. And that's the way the system is. And that's another issue that we may want to take up at some time.
Thank you. Representative Hertas, I had you first on the list.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Representative Anderson. I notice in the handout you gave or provided, the watershed is encompassing more than 1,000 square miles, almost 650,000 acres of land. And if the current spending were actually levied on a per acre basis, that amounts to, you know, more than a dollar and a quarter per acre, but it's not being done that way. Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, testifiers, thank you for bringing a chronic problem that has been growing over a period of time. My first involvement with watersheds and water management districts goes back more than 10 years. And what we are seeing, Mr. Chair, and what these folks are here about is an increasing amount of money that is being spent administratively over time and not really dealing with the charge or the mission of the watershed districts and actually using the money to have water projects that actually improve the quality of the water. And so these districts have oftentimes, as mentioned, are appointed people. It has levy authority and taxing authority, and Western Hennepin County is not unique to the problems that are all around the state with regard to the Clean Water Act, which had a good intention of addressing issues that are of major concern to everybody. And I would be among the first to want to advocate that we do everything we can do to ensure that future generations do have clean water. But when we're spending it all on salaries and wages and administration, which is becoming more and more bloated, it's not really putting money to actually solving the problems. And case in point, in Western Hennepin County, we have some of these water management districts, we have the same individual who acts as contract administrators and has a boilerplate function of creating minutes and meetings and doing all of this stuff, and is collecting a fee from all of these different water management districts that are served, and it's become quite a lucrative $250,000 a year occupation. That isn't doing anything to clean water other than shuffling paper. And so thank you, gentlemen, for being here.
Okay, I do have Representative Draskowski next, but I do have members here from the watershed that have come to testify as well, so I want to make sure that they have a chance as well. Representative Draskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just curious, maybe Mr. Swanson or Ms. Hagler can tell us how many of these watershed districts have law that deviates from the standard 250,000.01% of EMV. Is this the only one?
Mr. Chair and Representative Draskowski, I'm not sure how many have this sort of special additional levy authority, but I can certainly check on that and get back to the committee.
Thank you. I think that would be helpful. Maybe Representative Anderson, if I could, Mr. Chair.
Oh, absolutely. Please.
Thank you. Representative Anderson, why not go back to the 250 that the rest of the districts are originally authorized for, instead of only dropping to 500,000?
Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Draskowski, I will readily admit that this is a large watershed. It makes up portions of five counties: Todd, Douglas, Stearns, Meeker, and Polk. It's a large area, and I can't speak for what happened back in 2005, but I would assume the reason for granting them that higher ceiling was because of the size of the watershed. There may be some other watersheds that have this type of thing, or at least maybe go up to 500,000, and that's the reason that I lower this to 500. It is a substantial drop from what it currently is, but again, it is a pretty large watershed.
Representative Draskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for bringing the bill, guys.
Okay. We'd like to bring up testifiers from the audience. Folks. Yes. So, okay, good. I have a Mr. Scott Henderson and others. Fantastic. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself to the record and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, representatives, thank you. My name is Scott Henderson. I'm the district administrator for the Sauk River Watershed District. Thank you for the time today. Want to introduce yourself? Okay. Sauk River Watershed District, I think we kind of talked about it. It's about 1,000 square miles, encompassing five counties there in central Minnesota. Representative Anderson talked about those counties. We are a large watershed, and with a large watershed comes a lot of different services that we've increased with the amount of levy that we've been able to increase. We have a very robust education and outreach now. We go to, there's 13 school districts that touch the watershed district, and we utilize some of our levy fund to go into those schools and to teach K through 12. Every fourth grader that comes to the watershed district or lives within the watershed district has a possibility to come to a water fest once or twice a year, where it's hands-on, teaching fourth graders about the importance of water quality, natural resources, animals, that sort of thing. We've also increased our monitoring department, or the way that we go about and do sampling. all five soil and water conservation districts within the watershed utilize that data along with the state to see how the SWCDs, the work that they're doing is improving water quality, and how the watershed district is improving the water quality. You can see there, I think everyone has this kind of handout. It kind of shows the breakdown since about 2010, which would have been the first year that the watershed district levied more than the $500,000 that's being proposed. You can see there that the watershed district is pretty conscientious. We've never reached the cap, and I don't foresee us ever reaching that cap. Someone had said, you know, we would love to have all of that money go to implementing projects. Unfortunately, it takes people to implement those projects. It takes building, office, supplies to do that work. And so farther down that page, it kind of shows that we're about a 60-40 split right now. 60% does go to the people that do the work. 40%, though, goes back to being able to do the monitoring, utilities, take trainings, bring people into the watershed district to learn. And so I think it's very important that it's not just about us hiring people and having, you know, seats, having butts in seats. We're trying to give that money and utilizing it back into the watershed district. Since about 94, every dollar that we levy, we bring in about $2.22 in grants and loans, again, to help offset those levies and to implement projects and programs. And so I think it's been pretty important for us, the amount that we can levy it, we're showing that we're trying to add state funding and federal funding back into the watershed area. With us decreasing that our ability may get hurt if we decrease our levy. The special services and programs like our education and outreach, if we do get our levy cut, those definitely will go away. And that's unfortunately the hard truth about it. I'm really, some of the projects that were discussed, it's a special assessment project. And so it's based on a water quality benefit. The folks that benefit from that project pay for it. So the previous speakers who talked about those projects, this general levy doesn't affect our ability to do those projects and utilize special assessments to get the project paid for. And so this is kind of, Representative Anderson kind of said it. It's two different pots that they were kind of representing up here. General levy allows us to operate, but does not affect the way that we would do implementing and maintaining a project when we utilize a special assessment.
Thank you. Hello.
Hello.
Would you like to introduce yourself and provide any additional testimony?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Emily Javens. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Association of Watershed Districts, MAUD, and we oppose House File 3502. We have reviewed the actions of the Watershed District and believe they have been acting fiscally and are continuing to act fiscally responsible. And I know I'm their lobbyist, and so maybe that doesn't hold a lot of weight to say, oh yeah, we think they're responsible, but we want all of the members of our team to be strong. And if you don't trust my word on that, it was mentioned that the state said there should be more accountability for watershed districts, and that did happen. And it hasn't been 13 years that there hasn't been accountability. The Minnesota Board of Water and Soil Resources did implement a program, the Performance Review and Assessment, and I did check those records, and they have performed according to all of the duties that they are supposed to do over the years. And we do have the Assistant Director of Bowser that could speak to that also, but there is accountability, and it is checked every year. The watershed districts are very diverse, very different, and they're not created equal. There is only one watershed district that has that unique piece in legislation, but there are many different funding mechanisms. In the metro, the watershed districts operate under Minnesota Statute 103B, and they don't have that $250,000 cap. They're allowed to be able to levy based on their watershed management plan. In the Red River Valley, up in the northwest part of the state, if they are members of the Red River Watershed Management Board, there's a special ability for that board to tax an additional amount to put in those large impoundment projects, and then they get half of that money back to their watershed. So there are these small rural, or these, not small, watershed districts in the rural area that are not in the metro and not in the Red River Valley that are capped at this $250,000. And back when that law was passed, in session law, all five counties passed resolutions in support of this special law that was written for the watershed district. And just to note, there are two caps. There is the cap of the 250, which they no longer have, but there's also the cap in law for the watershed districts to do that 0.048, but they accepted a smaller percentage cap. So instead of 0.048, they're at 0.01. So they accepted a smaller percentage cap, and but then they didn't have to follow the 250. So it is still capped. It would be a misstatement to say that it's not. It is a very large watershed district that we can see from that. Let's see, kind of lost my train of thought I got going. But anyways, I guess we do oppose this bill. I do think they are one of the, best performers in the watershed district world, and I don't think that now is the time to go backwards on working on water projects and cleaning up the waters. This district was formed by citizens that wanted to work on the chain of lakes, and that the head of that is Lake Osakis. And the project that they built, one project has reduced one-third of the pollutant load that's needed to get out of Lake Osakis to make that fishable and swimmable again. One project. Last summer when they did the clean out, 1,800 truckloads of sediment was removed from the treatment ponds. That is 1,800 truckloads of sediment that did not go into Lake Osakis. If I could find one of those projects to put in every single watershed outside of every single lake, that would be phenomenal. I'm an engineer. That is a wonderful, perfect project. It takes very sediment and pollutant-laden water, takes it offline, cleans it up, discharges it back before it reaches the lake. It was an incredible project that is working. And with that, I would stand for any questions.
Thank you. We do have some member questions here. Representative Gomez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wonder if our testifiers can tell us a little bit about, you talked about the size of this particular watershed district. Can you talk about the way that sort of the expectations about the level of service that you would provide for the communities in the watershed district have increased over the years that might lead to the need for some of these improvements that you're trying to do?
Sure.
Mr. Henderson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think the main increase that we really see is that outreach education. 1,000 square miles it's large. That's bigger than, I think, 4 out of the 5 counties size-wise. And so the fact that we can bring educational materials to K through 12, we are in the schools. Like we don't just hand the teachers. We come in, we teach them. It's very hands-on. We have different kits, whether you're talking about Enviroscapes, which show how water interacts with different landscapes, feats and fur. So it's not just about water quality. It's about natural resources and animals and everything else is pretty large. And I kind of touched on also our monitoring. Our monitoring department used to be we'd hit a couple spots here and there. 120 miles of river. We have 10 anchor sites on the river. So that's 10 different areas that we look and see within a sub-watershed, how are we doing in that sub-watershed? So sub-watershed is just a little area of the bigger one. And we have different points along that river that we monitor from ice off all the way through. We've actually pushed it. They usually stop in September. We push it to October to make sure that we can understand what's going on with different seasonal variations, rainfall variations. And so that is something that has increased since 13 on. And so we've also increased our lake monitoring. We now, there's about 191 lakes. We monitor 40 on a rotational basis to ensure, again, that not just the watershed district, but all of our partners, the projects that they're doing, that they're utilizing state funds, that the projects they're doing are helping us improve water quality.
Representative Gomez, did you have a follow-up?
Yeah, if I could, thank you for that. I also, I think you covered this a little bit, but you talked about these special assessment funded, they're sort of like repair kind of drainage improvement projects. And then this is like this separate general levy. And can you talk a little bit more about the connection between those two things? Because I guess I just kind of got the sense that people were like, you know, wanted the actual like projects to happen that help improve our water. Like we all agree that you know, when we hear about how many of our waters are impaired and kind of knowing how central that is to like human life and also to the unique things about Minnesota. So I wonder if you could just kind of talk a little bit more about the connection between the money that's raised with the general levy and those like specific drainage and water quality improvement projects that happen within the watershed.
Mr. Henderson, and I do want to give you a chance to respond, but members, we have one more bill after this. We have about 10 minutes left. So if we can be succinct with our responses, I do still want to get through all member questions on this particular bill, but for everybody here, if we can be succinct with our questioning and succinct with our responses, we can get through our agenda today. So thank you. Please proceed.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the way that projects tend to happen is the general fund, we utilize the general fund to figure out which projects to do. So we're looking at monitoring data, we're looking at areas in the landscape, where's a project gonna go? That's all general fund. Once a project is done, we utilize 103D, state statute 103D, to figure out how are we gonna pay for that project to go in. Sometimes it's utilizing grants, sometimes it's utilizing special assessments, who's benefiting from that project, people that benefit for the project pay for the project. So that is where special assessments would come in. So getting the project initiated and on the ground would be general fund. Long-term maintenance, helping to pay for that project is special assessment or grant funding, loan funding.
Thank you. Next on the list, I have Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll be quite brief. I think this is for Mr. Henderson. I realize that you have a lot of monitoring and we're talking about the funding mechanism, and so you have in your report all the programs that you have, but I'm surprised with all the monitoring you have that you didn't provide us with the data on how effective and whether or not the programs that you're doing are actually working. So my just request is, could you get that information to this committee and send it around to us? I would really appreciate that, because it seems that that's where we really want to make sure we spend the money to make sure that it's actually working, not whether or not we've got it in programs that are out there.
Mr. Henderson.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Representative, I will send on, we have monitoring reports for the last, I'll send you the most recent monitoring report that we have.
Summary.
Yep, and that'll be perfect. I can send that on to Nathan and he'll disperse that.
Thank you. Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a question regarding the Legacy's Clean Water Fund grants. How many projects throughout the years has the Watershed District either applied and or have been awarded a grant money, and maybe a number if you had that as well?
Mr. Henderson.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Representative, I, off the top of my head, I don't have that, but I will send that on to Nathan to pass on to you.
Representative McDonald.
Follow up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, but there, you have qualified and have received grants from our Clean Water Fund, correct, for projects?
Mr. Henderson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, we've received money through the Bowser, MPCA, Lasard Sam's Outdoor Heritage Council. Roughly since 1994, we've brought in about $11 million in grants.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you. We'll look forward to that report along with Representative Petersburg's request at your convenience. Thank you.
Thank you.
Excellent. Last on the list, I have Representative Brumbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Wanted to ask the association folks, do you have a lobbyist? Do you employ a lobbyist for your organization?
Yes, we do have a part-time lobbyist, and I'm the executive director, and of course, I'm here doing a little lobbying right now. So I do a little bit, and then we do have a lobbyist also.
All right, thank you. And just one other quick one.
Sure.
In the statute that authorizes watershed districts, does that specifically spell out that there can, that you're doing to do education and outreach?
Who wants to take that one?
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes. Yes, education and outreach is a portion of that, yes.
Thanks.
All right. Seeing no further member questions, Representative Anderson, some brief closing comments, please.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mr. Chair, members, for hearing this bill. I think it's something we're going to have to look at some point. The costs to make these cleanups are so expensive that putting them on One farmer I knew, he has a 200-acre farm. His assessments were $68,000 to clean up his portion of the river. So it's really expensive. But thanks for hearing the bill, and I appreciate the committee's indulgence.
Thank you, Representative Anderson. And with that, Representative Zhang renews his motion that House File 3502 be laid over for possible inclusion in the division report. And with that, it has been laid over. Next up, folks, if I could keep your attention for one last bill. We have House File 346, so we're going way back in the time machine here. This is my bill. I'm not planning to take any formal presentation. However, I do move that House File 346 be laid over for possible inclusion. This is a potential vehicle bill for the division report. This bill simply states that local lodging taxes apply to the whole price of lodging, including services provided by accommodation intermediaries. These are groups such as Expedia. This conforms to the definition used for the state sales tax and for local lodging tax currently collected by the state. Oh, yes, as I'm reminded, this was heard last year. And in this division. So just know that the reason for the expedition is because of having heard this bill last year. However, I know that there are folks here today who want to come testify. Mr. Carlson had indicated, yes, there he is. Mr. Carlson, please come forward, introduce yourself for the record, and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Joel Carlson. I own a legal research and government affairs business here in St. Paul, and I represent people that are in the travel intermediary business, companies like Expedia, travel agents, resorts, and others. And this is the 11th time I've been in front of this committee on this issue, and I hope the 11th time is not a charm. You know, travel agents, let me just say and be very brief, this bill is just impossible to administer. To make all of these lodging intermediaries, travel agents, tour groups become local lodging taxpayers in over 130 jurisdictions, it's just impossible to administer. It will result in fewer properties being able to take advantage of free online marketing, and is just the wrong direction for us to go. You know, in 2011, the legislature put a sales tax on travel agents, and we acknowledge that and we pay that, but they never amended lodging tax. And now this double taxation, where we would now pay a sales tax on our service, we don't provide lodging. Lodging is imposed on lodging service, on lodging itself. We don't provide that. We get sales tax on our service. We don't pay lodging tax. It's not part of lodging. And, you know, not only is this bill difficult to administer, it's retroactive for 9 years. It allows for not just the 3% sale lodging tax that is imposed. This allows for any special law that is approved to make us pay the full tax that is charged. Bloomington, for example, has lodging tax that's higher than the state sales tax. We would pay more to Bloomington under this bill than we would pay to the state of Minnesota for our sales tax obligation. It's just unfair. It's unworkable. I hope you continue to say no. Happy to answer questions, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. We're going to proceed with our next testifier, then we could take some comments. Mr. Runling, welcome. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Shane Rudlang. I represent the Bloomington Port Authority and the city as well. I'm here to talk about the local lodging tax provision in House File 346. Simply stated, the city is in favor of having the same sales tax base apply to the state sales tax as the local lodging tax. So today, based on how you pay and when you pay for a hotel room online has an impact on whether or not you pay the local lodging tax. If you go on Expedia today and you click and book a $100 hotel room and you click pay later, you will pay sales tax on $100 and local lodging tax on something less than $100. And we think that is bad tax policy. if you go on Expedia today and click that $100 hotel room and purchase now, it's different. And so when you make the transaction and how you book the hotel room has an impact on what local lodging tax you pay. And we simply think that it should be the same no matter how you book that room, whether you're doing it through an Expedia website, whether you're doing it at Marriott.com, whether you come to the hotel and walk in and pay that amount. We simply think that's the right way to do things. As far as administrating it, a number of jurisdictions across the country have fixed this. And so it's been something that has been accomplished. There is some accounting, but there's ways that hotels can collect the tax at the point of sale and things like that. Point is it's been corrected around the country in a number of locations, and we simply think it's good tax policy to have the same tax base apply to no matter which tax you're paying. And with that, I'd stand for questions, and thank you for your time.
Mr. Runley, I know you ran through that quick, but just to restate what you had mentioned. So the room resellers, Expedia, Hotel.com, Travelocity, those online room sellers, currently only pay tax on the price negotiated with the hotel. They're not paying tax on what the consumer actually pays.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. So pretend the room is $100, and a person goes to Marriott.com, and they book that hotel room through Marriott.com. They'll pay sales tax on $100, and they'll pay lodging tax, whatever happens in the jurisdiction, whatever the rate is, on the $100 as well. If they go to Expedia.com, behind the scenes, there is some portion of that $100 that goes to the hotel and another portion that goes to Expedia as a booking fee. And what that amount is, what the percentage split is behind the scenes, is not visible to the customer, and it depends on each hotel's financials and the arrangement with Expedia and so on. And so just say that's $20 for the purpose of this example. $80 goes to the hotel and $20 goes to Expedia. If you do that transaction through Expedia, and once again, depending on when you pay, but just bear with me for a second, you'll pay sales tax and lodging tax on the 80, and you'll also pay sales tax on the 20, but you won't pay lodging tax on the 20, but only if the collection is made by the local jurisdiction. If the Department of Revenue collects, the law is clear. Well, there's a couple of lawsuits that are outstanding, but generally speaking, the law is clear that the travel intermediary should pay the lodging tax on the 20%. So what we're trying to do here with this bill is just to set the table and make it clean for everybody that the sales tax base is on $100, lodging tax base is on $100. No matter how you book, what website, how you pay, you should pay the same sales tax base on the transaction no matter what happens. The local hoteliers that own businesses in Minnesota support this bill. I've had hoteliers here throughout the years testify that they support this bill, and the only groups that dislike this bill are the out-of-state or out-of-country online travel resellers. And they provide a good service. This is nothing against them. We just think that the lodging tax should apply to the same tax base no matter how you book the room. That's it.
Thank you, Mr. Rowling. And Mr. Carlson, I see you have a comment to make, but I'm going to get to member questions real quick here. Members, we are 5 minutes past time, so if we can, again, be succinct so we can wrap up here in the next 5 minutes. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, and to the testifier. So the same Marriott has this room for $100, and you come in with your perks or a discount, and you only pay $80. What is collected then,
Mr. Runley?
Mr. Chair and Representative Petersburg. That's a good question, and I wish there was a hotelier here with me today to answer that. And I'm going to stop and not speculate on what happens if they have a perks for some amount.
Oh, members, there is a letter in your packet from Hoteliers Minnesota. I'm sorry, Hospitality Minnesota. Hospitality, Hoteliers. So take a look at that. I think that might get to some of the questions. Okay.
And Mr. Chairman,
I know
you don't want to belabor this, and I don't need to
either. Yep, I understand.
But Representative Petersburg, just to answer your question, we don't need to get a hotelier up here. The statute says right on its face, on line 1.10, what the lodging tax applies to. It applies to the total amount paid for the consideration of lodging. That's what it applies to. It does not apply to the service fee that a travel agent charges. They pay a sales tax on that, but lodging tax does not apply. It's right in the statute. This is not a clarification of existing law. And there is no reselling, Mr. Chairman. The travel agents never own a room and resell it. They simply are allowed to allow the hotelier to set their price for their room and be on their site or book their tour group. The hotelier sets that price. There's no reselling. There's no wholesale price. That just doesn't happen. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
Okay. With that, anybody else in the audience? No, we just did that. Okay. So I renew my motion that House File 346 be laid over for possible inclusion in the division report and that the bill be laid over. I had one announcement real quick. Let's see here. We're going to be meeting twice next week, next Monday at this time, and again on Wednesday. So mark your calendars. Wednesday, March 11th in room 5 at 8 a.m. So we're basically... Chair Marquardt was kind enough to donate his time for our good work. So plan on being early. Be sure to get your coffee beforehand. And then with that, members, we are adjourned.